Senate will come back to order, please. Messages from the House.
From the House of Representatives, January the 20th, 2011, third reading passed. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill 21, Battery Against a Family Member. Ayes 55, noes 3, excused 2. House Bill number 86, Compulsory School Attendance. Ayes 58, noes 0, excused 2. And House Bill 100, Game and Fish Land Acquisition. Ayes 54, noes 4, excused 2. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. From the House of Representatives, January the 20th, 2011, third reading passed, amended. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill number 20, Medicaid Reimbursement of Services, ayes 57, excused 3. House Bill 72, Teacher Merit Pay. Ayes 57, noes 3, excused 1. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Reports from standing committees.
January the 20th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporation Elections and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred Senate File 45, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Martin, and Scott, Senator Case, Chairman. January the 20th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporation Elections and Political Subdivision, to whom was referred Senate File 54, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, and Martin, excuse Senator Scott, Senator Case, Chairman. January the 20th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred Senate File 63, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senators Burns, Christensen, Dockstader, Driscoll, and Escobel, Senator Burns, Chairman. January the 20th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 12, Rules and Procedures, to whom was referred Senate File 69, reports back with the recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senators Anderson, Hastert, Martin, Nicholas, and Ross, Senator Anderson, Chairman. January the 20th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, and Wildlife and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred Senate File 62, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Burns, Christensen, Dockstader, Driscoll, and Escobel, Senator Burns, Chairman. January the 20th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred Senate File 39, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. I, Senator Burns, Christensen, Dockstader, Driscoll, and Escobel, Senator Burns, Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Perkins, did you have a request of the body?
Yes, thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I'd ask so that these things can be done in a timely fashion that you'd refer Senate File 90, Wyoming Nurse Practice Act Amendments, Senate File 93, Dietetics Licensure, and Senate File 94, Liability for Emergency Equipment Donations, from refer them to Committee Number 3.
Thank you. The request, of course, is to refer Senate File 90, 93, 94 to Committee Number 3. Revenue, seeing no objection. So be ordered. Thank you, Senator Perkins. members of the committee, we'll probably see a little more of that as we go along. We're trying to balance out our committees. We're beginning to sense the magnitude of the load here. And so we'll make these adjustments as we go along. I would also remind the body that, many of these committees are cross-pollinated in the fact that the chairman of judiciary also sets on revenue. And so I would think that these bills will get a fair hearing regardless of assignment. So having said that, thank you, Senator Perkins, and thank you, Senator Hines. We are now ready at that order of business for the considerations of bills on general file. Mr. Majority, floor leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that the Senate resolve itself back into committee of the whole.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion has carried. Senator Nutting, would you please return to the chair?
Committee of the Whole will please come to order. The first bill for our consideration is Senate File 51. The reading clerk will read the Senate file.
Senate File 51, Safety Belt Violations, an Act Relating to Motor Vehicles, sponsored by Senator Scott. It was referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Cooper, Johnson, Landon, and Schiffer. No, Senator Nutting, Senator Schiffer, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Schiffer.
Madam Chairman, moving the Committee of the Whole rise to report it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 51. And for a presentation of the bill, I yield to the sponsor, Senator Scott.
Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman, let me start out by saying, and something a number of you know, but I had no idea when I brought this bill how appropriate it was going to be. I had an experience last night. Was driving down Deming over there by the Holiday Inn, and somebody who had been stopped at a stop sign on a side street pulled out in front of me. If I hadn't been wearing my seatbelt and if they hadn't been wearing their seatbelt, we'd have probably all been in the hospital today instead of me being right here talking to you about seatbelts. Those things, I'll tell you now from personal experience, they work and they're a good deal. Let me first explain, Madam Chairman, what the bill does, and then explain the reasons for it and why it comes to be. First thing it does on page 2, it raises the fine for not wearing your seatbelt from $25 to $75. Then it changes the nature of the offense from the current secondary offense where you have to be stopped for something else to get a ticket to a primary offense where they can stop you for not wearing a seatbelt and go ahead and give you a ticket for just that. And that's what the repealer in section 2, page 2, line 24, that's what that does. The third thing it does is the language on lines 16 through 22, which is give your local folks authority to exempt from this law vehicles in a parade or something like that. And you say, why bother? Who would ever ticket the driver of a vehicle in a parade for not wearing a seatbelt? That's not the problem. The problem is that often the vehicles are some kind of commercial outfit that's lending it. Seatbelt laws apply to passengers as well, and that just doesn't work for people who are on the back trailer or sitting up in the back seat or something in a parade. And you may have problems then, particularly with commercial outfits, saying, well, I'm sorry, but we can't let you use the vehicle in the parade this year because our insurance regulations won't allow it, because otherwise you violate a state law. And this gives local people authority to deal with that particular problem. So that's what that language is about. Okay, simple enough to understand, Madam Chairman, what the bill does. What's the history on this? I got into this because there was a problem with the Wyoming workplace fatality rate. We were leading the nation in that particular category, and that's a category you'd rather be last rather than first. And the governor put together a task force on workplace fatalities. The management council assigned committee number 10 with the responsibility of responding to the findings of that task force. They reported to us, but they didn't get the job done until December, and they came last year to our last meeting, and there wasn't time to prepare a committee bill. And the primary thing they found was that majority, the figure I heard most recently was 60% of our workplace fatalities are motor vehicle accidents. And the primary thing that we could do about it was get people to wear their seat belts so there wouldn't be fatalities. And so that was their recommendation, that we raise the fine. We tried that, passed the Senate last year, came to grief over on the other side. And I brought the bill as a personal bill because it came to the committee too late for the preparation of even that simple a committee bill. Was contemplating doing it again this year, and the state epidemiologist, Dr. Ryan, who was appointed as a further part of the recommendations of that task force last year, came to me and said, you ought to make it a primary bill. And I was debating back and forth. And the lady who maintains our workplace fatality database in the Department of Employment goes to my church. And she knew I was worrying about this. Heck, it was in the newspaper. And did some research and brought some very good research. And let me quote from an article from the Journal, American Journal of Public Health. This is November 2006, volume 99, number 11. And it has some very interesting statistics. First, it has been estimated that the seat belts reduce the risk for fatality by 45% in passenger cars and 60% in light trucks. They really make a difference in terms of saving your life if you're in an accident. Second, our results suggest that states with secondary enforcement laws can increase belt use by 10 percentage points by upgrading to primary enforcement. You get a 10 percentage point increase in the use of seat belts going from secondary to primary. You got 10% going from nothing to secondary, you get another 10 percentage points going to primary. And as you raise the fine back in here further, you get 1.35% additional compliance for every 10 bucks you raise the fine in this range. And that's looking at the experience in all 50 states. So we have a pretty good notion what this is going to do. Wyoming's seatbelt usage is currently, the information I have is at 67%, and I think that's on a fact sheet that was passed out. This bill, with the fine increase and seatbelt usage increase, will result in about a 16.5 percentage point increase in compliance if statistically we behave as everybody else does. That cuts our rate of seatbelt non-usage in half. We had last year We had 100 fatalities, roughly. in people who were not wearing their seatbelt. Seatbelt usage could have cut the men, had changed it from 100 that were not wearing their seatbelt to 50. When you average the light trucks and the passenger cars, cuts it half again. Of the 50 who would have been wearing a seatbelt, 25 of them would have survived. There's also a monetary savings to our Medicaid program. It's $2.6 million is the figures we have, and that's, I think, before the federal share. So there's a savings there. It's primarily the Medicaid program. There's another savings to our workers' comp program, and the statisticians lumped that in with all other insurance, where the total savings was $13 million, and I can't tell you what proportion would be workers' comp, but a significant portion would be. So there's a monetary savings. Madam Chairman, this is the kind of bill that presents you as members of the Senate with a tough decision. And for your newcomers, this is what you put your money down and campaign got here for, so you could decide. Most of us, myself included, don't like the government telling us what to do. And this is government telling you what to do, telling you to wear a seatbelt or pay a fine. No two ways about it. Most of us, myself included, put a high value on human life. It's one of our core values, and we believe it. You pass this bill after it's been in effect for a year. There will be 25 more of our Wyoming citizens alive and walking around and able to complain to you about what the government's doing to them. So you've got two values in conflict. You got the value of not having the government interfere with you. You got the value of valuing human life very highly. And you're going to have to decide which value is more important. And I'll tell you from me, the value of human life is going to come ahead. Partly because of the lives of the people whose life will be saved. But also for the effect that it has on the families. Many of these crashes involve younger drivers who are just learning how to drive. And excuse me, Madam Chairman. No, Madam Chairman, excuse me. I can tell you from personal experience what it's like to lose a child. In an auto accident.
I think it would be wise for us to stand at ease with
the... The body stands at ease. We will take a short recess until the sound of the gavel. The Senate will come to order. We'll resume with the Committee of the Whole. Senator Scott.
Apologize for the Senate. I didn't think that that would affect me that way, but it did. With that, Madam Chairman, I've explained the need for the bill and the details of the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Discussion on the bill. Senator Schiffer.
Madam Chairman, on the bill, Madam Chairman, when we first started working the what we've got in statute right now, the approach of the legislature, and I think it's a very typical approach in Wyoming, is to make it very much an incentive. In other words, we try not to pass many of the laws that other states pass that are punitive, that are restrictive, that are, take a big hammer and say, now you got to do it or I'm going to hit you with a big hammer. We don't do that much in this state. We try not to do that. In the seatbelt law, we followed what we do. We say, okay, we're going to try and do it, and we're going to try and make it so that people buy into it in the least restrictive manner. And that's why we ended up, it was a secondary offense. But the penalty part of it was you get, when you got stopped for, well, I'll use an example of somebody I know. I'm driving my pickup down. I couldn't believe this, but I'm driving my pickup, innocent, almost. And a highway patrolman pulls me over because my license tags had been expired for almost 9 months. And it was oversight. You got to make those colors brighter. How that guy could even read a wee bit of a little tag. It's about like that, Madam Chairman.
Covered up with mud.
Covered up with mud, and it, you know, but he could. That, but anyway, he pulled me over. Legitimately so. It had been expired for quite a while. But because I'm wearing my seatbelt, my contribution to the schools was lowered by $10. And that's the way we approach things. What's in front of you today is going the other direction. It is saying, this is going to be punitive. This is going to make it primary offense, and by the way, we're going to raise the fine by a multiple of whatever it is, 300. Well, it goes from being a deduct into a $75 fine. That's pretty hefty in this world. You got to remember, this is not a primary offense, traffic offense, doesn't go on your record or anything like that, but a $75 fine is substantial. I worry some that we're starting to do some things like this that maybe we don't need to. And I realize the impetus for this came from work safety. Well, let's look at work safety. Industry can do some things that makes, that really cuts those, the accident rate down. Let me give you a couple examples. The coal industry up in the northeast corner. When that thing started out, Highway 59 was a terrible highway. It was unsafe. Couldn't handle it. And the coal industry got on board and said, and they talked to us and said, you got to fix this highway. You got to fix this highway. We started out with passing lanes, making it three-lane. Now in some places it's four-lane. What did the industry do? They stepped up. And they said, we're going to bust those workers. You come out of Gillette, you park there. I forget what the, it's right off the highway. We'll take you on a bus. You go to work. If you're coming out of the Newcastle area, There's a place to meet the bus over there, a regular paved parking lot. So they don't have people driving unnecessary miles to get to work. They'll bus them into the mine, do their shift, bus them back to their vehicle. That's an industry that stepped up to the plate and said, we believe in worker safety, and then put their money where their mouth is. It's the standard in the Powder River Basin coal industry now. Absolutely the standard. Now, the railroads. What's the old saying? We all love trains, but we hate railroad companies. The railroads. If you're on a railroad crew, you've got to go pick your train up in, West Gillette. And you live in Sheridan, they'll put you in a van. They haul you to where you pick your train up. You pick it up. When your shift's done, they pick you up and take you back home. There's an industry that stepped up and said, we don't want whatever a crew is, 5, 6, 7, 8 people, going to find the train in various places. Industry is capable of doing that. There are certain companies in the petroleum industry that have stepped up and said, nope, you're not going to be driving individually. You're going to stay where we tell you to stay, and you're going to go out and work on the rig, and then you're going to come back there. I don't forget what they're on. I think it's a 12-day shift, if I remember. But while you're working for the company, while you're on the job, you're not out driving up and down commuting hundreds of miles. So it can be done. Industry can set a standard that dramatically impacts safety. I'm not sure that going down the route we're starting at, because we all know what the next step is. If $75 fine is good, boy, let's hammer them for $250. Then we'll really gouge them. And those that are really dumb learners, we'll catch those at $300. I mean, that's what other states do. I just think that we should step back and say, now, wait a minute here, folks. Maybe we need to think about this. There's two parts to this bill. I hope you'll look at both of them, because together they totally change how we have approached seatbelt and seatbelt enforcement. Fundamentally change it to what I believe is a philosophy that so far has been alien to this state. And I worry if we start down that road of being punitive and rather than trying to encourage people to do what's right for them anyway.
Senator Cole.
Madam Chairman, let it be known that I've paid my fair share into the school fund, although I don't think I have a conflict of interest on this bill. Some of the concerns I have for the good senator from Natrona County. What about the passengers in the vehicles? I can't recall right now how that is. What if you're driving and you've got your seatbelt on? What about the passengers? The other question I have is, how are you going to enforce it? It's going to be very difficult to see, I think, for a state trooper or a policeman, actually see if you've got your seatbelt on with tinted windows and all the other stuff. Now, I wear mine all the time because I can't stand those bells all the time going off when you don't put it on. And most cars do that, but those are a couple of questions I have.
Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman, let me respond. First, on the matter of the incentives, this bill does not change the current incentive system. The incentives are left intact. They're still there. So if you get stopped for something else and you got your seatbelt on, you still get the incentive. But we don't change that. I think that's important. Second, the enforcement, like everything in this world, is not necessarily perfect. And there'll be some cases probably where the patrolman will think he doesn't see a seatbelt. He stops you, you've got it. You're good to go. I've heard of that anecdotally. That happens in other states. Will happen here.
it's easier to see on two-lane roads than four-lane interstates. It's easier to see in town circumstances where many of our accidents are, where many people tend to say, oh, I'm just going a few blocks and not bother, and are running a risk. So it's easier to force in towns. And those enforcement difficulties are common ones all across the 50 states. And the statistics we're using are derived from the experience elsewhere in the United States as well as our own experience. So they show what you get from moving the law, given the difficulties of enforcement. You get 10 percentage points. And let me remind the Senate. Yes, we talk a lot of the time about philosophical differences, and we try to say, given our philosophy, this is what we think the result's what we're going to do. This one, we've got statistics. Yes, the numbers will bounce around because that's the nature of things. You get affected by some random events. But we know, to a degree we usually don't, what the outcomes of our actions are. And as I said, it's a conflict in values. Do you go with the value that says, we don't like the government telling us what to do? Or do you go with the value that says, if we pass this bill and it becomes law, in a year, when it's been in effect for a year, it goes into effect July 1st. There will be 25 more people, almost as many people as there are here in the Senate, who will be alive and enjoying life who would otherwise be dead. So what's your value? Not interfering with people. Human life. It's not an easy choice. It's the choice the voters have paid us to make. Madam Chairman, I urge adoption of the bill.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I think I'm against this bill, but I have a couple of questions. But first of all, an observation, I always get shivers down my spine when somebody is proposing a bill or speaking on behalf of the bill and saying, let's be more like other states. That's the last thing. That's kind of like on a national level saying, let's be more like Europe. It doesn't really resonate with me. But a couple of questions for the sponsor of the bill. It's easier to spot somebody on a two-lane road, but what about at night? How easy or hard is that? How much of this would be dependent on the perception of the policeman at night? I thought I saw a seatbelt. I thought I didn't see a seatbelt. I think that may be a problem. The next question I have is, how does this apply to ag vehicles? Ag vehicles, agricultural vehicles, tractors and so forth that you see going down the road. Does it apply to them? And what about those vehicles a few years ago that we allowed the licensing of, such as ATVs? Would they be subject to a bill like this? Because a lot of them don't have seat belts. And when you get to this balance of if we're going to save 25 lives versus a certain inconvenience, then frankly, wouldn't that not also be an argument for lowering the speed limit, say, on the interstate down to 50? Because it'll save that many more lives in the long run, but you do have to balance that with the convenience of the citizens of the state.
Senator Van Slateren.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Standing in support of this bill, I go from a different tact on this. You know, your insurance rates are based on accidents, severity of accidents, property damage. So somebody driving without a seatbelt is costing me money. I'm paying several vehicles worth of insurance, and my rates are higher because in this state, we have one of the worst fatality rates per accident. So going from that point of view, that's just dollars in your pocket, or dollars that aren't in your pocket. For the good senator from KC with the dirty pickup, I could tell you that the $25 in inflation terms, and you may have been here when we put the first seatbelt law on, or maybe you were here before when we first registered vehicles, but that's worth about $6 now or something in inflation value. And speeding tickets have risen accordingly. And speeding tickets, the fact that I have to pay $100 should I ever speed for going 60 or 72 in a 65, that's risen with inflation. That's a deterrent. I don't, 69 and a 65, kind of standard. This hasn't risen. Yes, you need a deterrent. You're costing me money. You know, if you're costing me money, I do want you to wear your seatbelt. And I doubt anybody in this room. Now, I bet everybody in this room wears a seatbelt 90% of the time. And as far as ATVs, one of the things with ATVs and little bobcat skid steers and all those is you want to wear a seatbelt in them. And I think most, if not all, new ones have seatbelts. And I think there is, within the automobile, if it wasn't on factory original, signal lights on a 1928 car, you don't have to have it. It doesn't apply. You're grandfathered in. I think it would be the same thing if the manufacturer did not put seatbelts on that ATV. But ATVs and those kind of things that can buck you off, you want to wear a seatbelt. And if it's on the road and you've gotten that, we've granted that authority to put that on the road, I hope you comply with the laws with it. So, in great support of this bill, I hope you vote for it.
Senator Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. To my good friend on Bates Creek, I stand in opposition not because it's a bad thing. I think it's really a slippery slope, and it's exactly what you addressed. It's back to values in Wyoming, and we've always really treasured our freedoms and our values, and we're where California was 50 years ago. And you take the first notch out, and you take the second notch, and next thing you know, we're down to 40-mile-an-hour speed limits, and seat belts on our horses, things that buck. And you can't make people totally safe. The laws that now stands, it's illegal not to have your seat belt on. It is the law. So what the bill really does is provide some incentives, but it also changes what our attitude in Wyoming is towards personal safety and personal responsibility. And we have the law in place. It's really important that we maintain our individual rights in Wyoming. And if it costs a few bucks on your insurance, we can't get your insurance to zero. There's still going to be accidents and terrible things happen. What we really need to do is continue down the path of encouraging people to be free, to value that freedom, and to be smart enough not to put them in situations that we have to legislate it back out. I'd really encourage us not to go down this path of trying to make ourselves so safe that we hurt our individual freedoms.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm standing in support of the bill, but with some reservation. I respect the concerns that we have about limiting freedom and about moving down the slippery slope. But I am in absolute agreement with my good senator over here that feels that we're not willing to pay for that freedom. We're not willing to pay extra while we wear our seatbelts so that others cannot wear their seatbelts and encumber additional costs to the state and to our insurance. So there needs to be a balance there. The $75 raise, the raise from $25 to $75 that's proposed in this bill is a reasonable incentive to maintain the spirit of this original law and take it up to the date where it is to the point where it's sufficient to actually provide an incentive for people to wear their seatbelt. However, I personally am uncomfortable with the repealer in Section 2, line 24 of page 2. I think that's a big step. I think when you say that an individual may be pulled over specifically for not wearing a seatbelt, then maybe we're taking a step down a road that we don't want to go down. So at this point on first reading, I'll be in support of this bill, but I would like to see some consideration given before our next reading to the possibility of removing that repealer. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Senator Landon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have sat through a lot of the meetings with our good chairman of Health and Labor. We've also studied this issue in, on our Transportation Committee the past 3 years. I didn't ever really think I would stand in support of a measure like this, but I wanted to let you know why I was a quiet yes in committee. We had a lot of compelling testimony. The one thing that stayed in my mind as we brought this down to the chamber floor was, how much are we willing to pay out of the state coffers? We're always reminded by the good senator from Albany County back there who stands up to say, you know, how much is this worth and how much you're willing to pay for this? This is a $5 to $10 million bill every year for you to pay so that some people cannot wear a seatbelt out there. That's what got my attention. Somebody goes off the road and rolls a vehicle and dies, and that young family back home now has to apply for services with the Department of Family Services. There's, if he doesn't die, there's workers' comp involved. Medicaid gets hammered. We're $30, $40 million in the hole in Medicaid as we stand here today. That begins to get my attention. You know, how much is the freedom for somebody out there to not have to wear a seatbelt? How much is that worth? The good senator from Natrona County just got done telling us that's worth about $5 to $10 million next year. And for me, that gets my attention.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. With respect to the comments out there, there's no question this is going to save lives. But when we talk about freedom, it's not the freedom to wear a seatbelt. It's not the freedom that we're talking about here. What you're talking about is a continuing infringement, an encroachment on individual rights. What the good senator back here from Sheridan was talking to is, when if you don't have a seatbelt on, it's a primary offense, and the officer believes that he saw that you didn't have a seatbelt on, that's a pretext for a lawful stop. Out of the lawful stop becomes the potential for search and seizures. It invokes all kinds of First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendment rights that are out there. Your rights aren't eroded in one big fell swoop. It's not by an encroaching army. It's not by people who come in and you'll usurp the government overnight. It's by just a steady encroachment of us saying, you know what, if we encroach on this freedom a little bit here, it's okay. If we encroach on this little freedom over here, it's okay. And gosh, we can find some justification to encroach on the freedom over here, and pretty soon we don't have any. And so you vote this up or you vote this down, but this isn't about the right to be free from wearing a seatbelt. It extends further than that, and we do this session after session. We come down here and do this, and not just on this issue, but on a number of issues. And we have to be ever vigilant about the cumulative effect of what we do here. And so you can vote this up or vote this down, but this is a continuing accumulation of encroachment on other rights, and it has a lot of other ramifications other than whether or not someone wears a seatbelt and whether or not we have Medicaid issues. So you vote it up and vote your conscience, but it's not just about freedom for somebody to wear a seatbelt and golly, that's not fair because I have to wear mine.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just a question for the sponsor of the bill and the testimony that you heard in committee, and I'm a big fan of incentives. I always have been, and I remember when we did this, and it really seemed to work, and, of course, there's a lot of pluses to what Wyoming's been able to do over the years, and we're doing better all the time. Doesn't mean we haven't got far enough, and certainly human life is so precious, and we all understand and agree with that. But just did you think about a further incentive if you wanted to raise the the fines to higher levels without getting into the primary offense to incentivize it. Because what I hear from people that get picked up, they always say, well, you know, the legislature really was trying to do some things that would provide us with incentive to do it. You know, that's not what usually we do. We tell them what to do, and then we suffer the consequences, and they ultimately are the ones that come back to us, and then we debate it, we talk about it. But when we incentivize, those kind of things really work. And then I looked at the statistics, and we're doing something right. Because over the last few years, you know, the deaths have gone down. Now, you may say it's a little glitch in the way we do it, the way we collect the data, but we are doing some things better. Is it because we're talking about it? Is it because we're discussing it? Is it because we're making people more aware of it? We're making progress. We really are. Is that because of the way we're approaching it, and if that's the case, then why do we not want to do more of that? And I think that I would be curious as to if you had any of that kind of testimony in the committee.
Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman, yes, but it was primarily last year. The bill that came in last year, amongst other things, proposed to raise the incentives. And that got a hostile fiscal note because that cost the Common School Fund money. But it raised quite a bit of testimony in committee, and forgive me if my memory is less than perfect from one year to the next, but there was considerable objection to the additional incentive, and the primary complaint was that the incentive wasn't doing any good because most people didn't know it was there. And it was particularly the Highway Patrol saying, as I remember, that law enforcement was saying that when they'd stop some people and let them know that there was an incentive, the typical reaction was, gee, I had no idea that was there. So the incentive appears to be ineffective because people simply don't know about it. As to why the accident rate is down, primarily I think that's an economic effect at this point. It's been the case, particularly with our workplace accidents, that they do trace with our economy. With less economic activity for all kinds of reasons, and there has been a slowdown. Hopefully it's picking up again. But there's less people on the road and less accidents, both in workplace situations and otherwise, non-workplace accidents. So that appears to be the primary effect there.
Is there any other discussion? Senator Hicks.
Madam Chairman, if I may, this is an issue that's very personal. Two family members. And the accident reports come out and said, had they been wearing their seatbelts, they'd both be alive today. But I'm here to tell you what I fundamentally know is, if we'd had this law in place with a $1,000 fine, they still would not be here. They wouldn't be here today. No matter how hard that this body or any body tries to legislate common sense, and that's what this is all about, is the common sense to do what's right, protect yourself and those that are around you. We can't do that. So it's very personal for me. But what I fundamentally know is they wouldn't be here today because I know these individuals. The highway that Mr. Schiffer died, I had a brother, died in a rollover accident up there on that very highway. And he never wore a seatbelt, and it was his God-given right, and that's the way he proceeded, and he would have resisted this law to the very point that he was willing to give his life, and he did give his life for that personal freedom. So we can legislate common sense, or we can attempt to. And I'll just tell you, it's not going to prevail. And I would contend that every person in this body has more power to reduce accidents by demanding that when people get in your vehicle that they absolutely have to wear a seatbelt. That when you send your child out, that you demand that they absolutely wear a seatbelt will save more people and more lives than all the attempts to try to legislate common sense. Thank you.
Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman, I've heard it said before on this floor, you can't legislate common sense. I would submit to you that we do that all the time. And the evidence from the experience with our fellow Americans elsewhere is that in this case, what we're doing here, we increase the amount of common sense by about 50%. And that translates into lives saved. I urge adoption of the bill.
All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 51, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
A division has been called. All of those in favor of Senate File 51, please stand. All those opposed, please stand. Senate File 51. Pardon? Oh, the math is wrong. Oh, that's good. Okay. Yes, Mr. President.
Gifford's motion rather than Senator Scott, and we might repeat that in order to clear the record.
Senator Schiffer, would you repeat your motion, please?
No.
All you need to do is repeat the action of the House in that bill has passed on the basis of Senator Schiffer's motion.
Okay. Senate File 51 has passed the Committee of the Whole based on the motion presented by Senator Schiffer. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 97. Senator Jennings. The total vote was 30, 17 to 13. It has been suggested that someone stood twice. Is it the pleasure of the body that we repeat the vote?
Adds to 30. Adds up to 30.
Senator Ross.
Madam Chairman, for purpose of clarity of the record, I suggest that you call for the motion based on Senator Schiffer's motion, and then we'll take and re-vote so that we make sure that we have everything in order.
All those in favor? I'm ready for that. All those in favor of Senator Schiffer's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 51, please stand. All those opposed, please stand.
No.
29, so somebody's still twice.
The total vote now stands at 29. Senate File 51 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 97. The reading clerk will read the Senate File.
Senate File 97, Concealed Weapons Retired Law Enforcement and Act Relating to Firearms, sponsored by Senator Rothfuss. It was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Barnard, Emmerich, Hines, and Perkins. No, Senator Case. Senator Hines, Chairman.
Senator Hines.
Madam Chair, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it does so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 97. There are no amendments, and I'll yield to the sponsor to explain the bill. Senator Rothfuss.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Committee, this is a bill that helps to clarify the standing of our retired law enforcement officers under Wyoming law with regard to their concealed carry rights. It's a relatively simple bill. If we work through the bill and look at page 1, it simply reiterates some of the concealed carry. And then on page 2, lines 13 and 14 of the bill under little 4 indicate that the person is a retired peace officer who otherwise meets requirements of 18 U.S.C. 926C. That creates a specific standing under our concealed carry law for retired peace officers who meet this federal statute. Now, each of you should have in your box a copy of that federal statute. If you look at the federal statute, what it says under little a is that notwithstanding any other provision of the law of any state or any political subdivision thereof, an individual who is a qualified retired law enforcement officer and who is carrying the identification required by subsection D may carry a concealed firearm that has been shipped or transported in interstate or foreign commerce subject to subsection B. So it basically gives standing to retired law enforcement officers as defined below to have concealed carry rights throughout the United States. The difficulty is that under little b, it indicates that this section shall not be construed to supersede or limit the laws of any state that under little 1, permit private persons or entities to prohibit or restrict the possession of concealed firearms on the property, or little 2, prohibit or restrict the possession of firearms on any state or local government property, installation, building, base, or park. Well, in the state of Wyoming, we basically have two levels of people who are allowed to carry firearms. We have a peace officer level and a concealed carry permit holder level. And there are different laws in place for where those individuals are allowed to carry with their concealed permit in place. There is no clarification within current statute as to how somebody who is qualified under this federal provision is supposed to be characterized. We don't know if they would be bound by the restrictions that are under the rest of the concealed carry law, permit holder restrictions, which is the little T, if you happen to have a copy of that in your books handy, or if they would be less restricted as per the situation when they actually were a law enforcement officer. This particular bill simply clarifies that by giving them a standing such that they are not under the restrictions that we currently have for a regular concealed carry permit holder. So, for example, if I were to go out and get a regular concealed carry permit, there would be restrictions that would apply to me that the state has set up, and we'll probably hear more about that potentially in a later bill. But right now there are some restrictions. Whereas, for a retired law enforcement officer who is subject to this provision, there would be less restrictions applicable. Now, one of the things I'd like to point out, a couple of key points, it's been characterized that this is a concealed carry bill without permits or without any requirements, when in fact the reality is certainly the opposite. If you look at little C of the federal statute, it talks in great detail about what it takes to actually get one of these concealed carry permits under the federal provision. Under little C, it says that a qualified retired law enforcement officer means an individual who separated from service in good standing, and then down below it indicates that that individual has served as a law enforcement officer for an aggregate of 10 years or more, and during the most recent 12-month period has met qualification in firearms training for active law enforcement officers. This is not easy to obtain or achieve, and in fact, each and every year that you possess this permit, you have to requalify with the specific firearm that you're intending to carry, or you are no longer allowed to carry. This is a good bill, and what I feel it does is allows people who have had extensive training in law enforcement and in situations where there might be a need to use that concealed firearm, who know how to use it, who actually know how to handle those situations and have been trained. So this puts a group of people walking around Wyoming who are capable of protecting us because they were trained and qualified to protect us for many years and still are qualified to protect us today. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I stand open for questions.
Discussion. Senator Case.
Madam Chairman, I've never spoke against a gun bill in my whole life. Madam Chairman, that sounds great. I'm ready to vote for that. The fact is, those guys are already here. They've been here for years. And your federal government has decided that they should be allowed to carry guns in Wyoming. You know, I want everybody to carry a gun, frankly. That's pretty much where I am. I believe it's a constitutional right. But it really bothers me. Supposing instead of being the right to carry a gun under a permit, it was the right to speed. And they came here and they said, from now on, retired federal officers would have the right to exceed the speed limit. And we'd like that going forward. That'd be great. We could all sit around and talk about whether we want retired officers to be able to exceed the speed limit, perhaps like on-duty officers can. That's not what the bill's about. They've been exceeding the speed limit for 5 years or more. And now they're kind of figuring out there's some hitches in it, so they're coming to tell us that they're doing that. So they've been ignoring our permit system, our laws, and in the introduction of the bill, there was one slight little fuzzy because it said, our retired police officers in Wyoming. No, no, no. It's any retired police officer from anywhere. So I just have this issue about the relationship of the federal government with the states. We have a law in the books that has prescribed for years that you need a permit to carry a concealed weapon. That law has never provided that there was an exception for retired law enforcement. But lo and behold, retired police officers from other states have been carrying for some time. The hitch for the law and why we're doing it now is it's got a couple of wrinkles. Because the federal law enforcement agencies won't pay for the training. So they want our agencies to help and provide the training. And so it's a backdoor sneak. And you know what? I would go for a bill that says, from now on going forward, any retired law enforcement officer that's current can carry in Wyoming as if they had a permit, and they don't need a permit, and I'd be glad to have them. What really bothers me about this bill is the way it's a backdoor sneak, and it has to do with state sovereignty, and it indicates to me that they've been violating our law for a long time. Just because the federal government has something in its law that says, as long as the state doesn't have a specific law, we don't have to worry about it. That really does bother me.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'd just like a little more clarification on it because I, too, don't want to be accused of being against a gun bill. In our current law, It's 68104, and then it says you have to demonstrate a familiarity with firearms, and then it tells you how you're going to get that, and it's the completion of that National Gun Association course and law enforcement. And then there's another one that says law enforcement firearm safety course. You can do it that way. Experience with a firearm through participating in a shooting group. But it goes down. There's quite a few of these. But in paragraph F, it says honorable retirement as a federal or state peace officer who has a minimum of 10 years of service. That's in our statute right now. So if you have the 10 years, then if you go get a permit, which you all know how I feel about that, but if you go get a permit, then you're okay there. And so you don't have to go through the training. You just have to show that you've retired. And I guess there's a special little card you get when you retire from the feds to show you did this. I think what we're doing here, and not that I have a problem with it, but let's put it out there, is what by putting this new piece into the law is the next section tells you where you can't go. You can't go into schools. You can't go here and all government buildings. And I think what we're doing, and I'd like the sponsor to clarify this, I think what we're doing with this piece of legislation is saying you can't take a gun, concealed weapon of any kind, into a school or a government building except if you're under this. And so I'd really, now I'm not for or against it, well, I am kind of, but I just would like to have a better clarification of is that what we're doing with this law?
Senator Rolfes.
Madam Chairman, thank you, Senators, for the excellent questions. Addressing the concerns last to first, addressing my colleague from Natrona County, who has never spoken against a concealed carry piece of legislation and hopefully will not speak against this one, I believe you do have the correct view of one of the keys to what this is, in that little T section, which goes through and provides a list of places that under Wyoming statute, under Wyoming permit holder statute, that's a restrictive list. If you were a permit holder under this, so if you were one of these federal, under the federal statute, a retired law enforcement officer, you would only be bound by where you can or can't carry a firearm. Anywhere that it would be legal for you to carry a firearm, you would be allowed to carry it concealed. If it's illegal there, for example, federal courthouse, if it's illegal, well, you still can't carry it because it's against the law for you to carry it. So it gives you no right to carry in a location. It doesn't restrict your right to carry in a location. But if you are able to carry concealed under this, you can carry concealed anywhere you're allowed to go with a firearm. I hope that clarifies it. Now, we've got lots of different obscure laws on where you can and can't carry it and how property rights come into play. But basically, if you're eligible for this, if you're allowed to carry it, you can carry it concealed. And that's not the case for a regular permit holder. I hope that clarifies it, Senator. On to the considerations raised in the first conversation by my good colleague. There are some concerns here, and I'm sensitive to the concerns about the notwithstanding clause. I certainly am. I think what this body has to realize is that the notwithstanding clause is federal law, and it's true. We can rail against that. We could probably have a lawsuit against that. We could say that we don't like the federal government telling us as a state that they want to be able to give firearms to retired law enforcement officers and you know, basically we can just stick it to the federal government. But that doesn't really help us. And I know that we're doing that time and again, and we've got lots of other issues where we're going to try and stick it to the federal government. This one provides firearms for people who are well qualified, who will then be able to keep us safe. So let's choose our battles against the federal government where we don't like the outcome. this is a good outcome. All right, let's not worry so much about the notwithstanding clause this time. Let's see. There was one other point or two other points I wanted to address that were brought up, and I did say our retired police officers, and it's true, that was a good catch and it was a good clarification by my colleague. It would be any law enforcement officer that was in the state of Wyoming at that point, because that's covered by a federal law that would extend to law enforcement officers from a state to the east that came into the state of Wyoming. They would again be covered under this, so it is not exclusive, and that was a good catch. And the final point regarding a backdoor sneak of having been violating this, that's not exactly the case, because this statute has been on the books, and this is the federal law, and it's governing. And until we overturn that or rail against it or have a court case, they're not violating the law by carrying. They're in good standing with the law. They're perfectly consistent with the federal law. The fact that we don't like it does not mean they were breaking the law. The fact that we don't like the federal government telling us how we have to do things does not mean they were violating a law. It just means we don't like the law, and we don't like how the law was administered. So I don't want anyone to leave here with an impression that all of our retired law enforcement officers have been running around our state and other states in violation of anyone's laws. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I hope that clarifies things.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Boy, he had me on board with him right up there to the end. Any federal officer that falls under this federal guideline is legal, but it seems like it says here on this little A, notwithstanding any other provision of the law of the state or any other political subdivision. So I'm sorry, but I'll have to disagree with that. If you have these retired officers from another state that have been depending on the federal statute to conceal carry without a permit in Wyoming, they have most certainly been breaking the law. Sorry about that. They have been breaking the law because we do have it in our statute right there. We just went across it, that you have to have a permit to do that in Wyoming, and you don't have to take the training because you are the retired peace officer, but you do have to have the permit. So those guys have been kind of breaking the law, our law.
Senator Case.
Madam Chairman, I like our relationship with the federal government. I like our relationship with law enforcement from the other states. We have laws that allow them to come and be work with our law enforcement when you're active duty, when you're a federal police officer, or even in some circumstances police officer from other states. We will work with you. You come in, you can carry your weapon, you can even be deputized, and you have arresting authority. Federal officers all have arresting authority, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm okay with that. I understand that relationship. And I know and I understand that you're carrying guns as part of your job. We've had a system of having a permit system for concealed carry weapons for anybody other than law enforcement who carry it as part of their job. Now, retired law enforcement is not law enforcement. I'm proud of them, but they're not here being police officers. So they ought to be following our laws that we have about concealed carry. And I want and I appreciate their training. And I want them to serve and carry under our law. Now here's kind of the rub. If the law enforcement community, and I'm using the bigger word community to encompass the retired aspect, doesn't care about the laws with respect to concealed weapons and want to enforce them and live up to them, that really bothers me. Now, and it bothers me that, if the federal government would somehow think it's okay to override our concealed carry law for people that are retired. So that there's a group of people that I'm not sure who they respond to. And I could go to black helicopter level if I wanted to, and I'm not a black helicopter person. Not at all.
But it is kind of strange. Don't you think that's a little weird? The federal government would authorize people to carry guns concealed within the state of Wyoming who are not active duty police officers or military personnel. Now, is there a fix for this law? Yes, there's two ways to fix it. Give them special privileges with respect to a permit. Say they automatically qualify for a permit, which practically our law already says, but we could put in a specific requirement that would be, and that would fix it. Or, you know, we also have a bill progressing about concealed carry without a permit. Hasn't made it to the floor of the Senate yet. That's another way. They would certainly qualify under that. I want them to follow the law, but I am very bothered that they haven't followed it today, and they come in and tell us they'd like us to fix it to accommodate them.
Are you, having heard the call for the question, all those in favor of Senator Hines' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 97, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Division. All those in favor, please rise. All those opposed, please rise. Pursuant to Senate Rule 11-5, having failed a standing division vote, a roll call is required. The chief clerk will call the roll.
Barnard,
aye.
Bebout,
no.
Burns,
no.
Case,
no.
Christensen,
yes.
Coe,
no.
Cooper,
no.
Dockstader,
no.
Driscoll,
no.
Emmerich,
no.
Esquibel,
aye.
Geis,
no.
Hastert,
aye.
Hicks, Hines,
aye.
Jennings,
no.
Johnson,
no.
Landon,
no.
Martin,
aye.
Meyer,
no.
Nicholas,
no.
Nutting,
no.
Perkins,
no.
Peterson,
no.
Ross,
no.
Rothfuss,
aye.
Schiffer,
aye.
Scott,
Bonflatern? No.
President Anderson?
No.
Closing vote? Closing. Vote closed. 9 ayes, 21 noes.
Senate File 97, having failed a roll call vote pursuant to Senate Rule 11-5, is deemed indefinitely postponed. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 55. The reading clerk will read the Senate file.
Senate File 55, Subdivision Perimeter Partition Fencing and Act Relating to Subdivision, sponsored by the Agriculture Committee. It was assigned to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State and Public Lands and Water Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Driscoll, Emmerich, Geis, and Hicks. Senator Geis, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure?
Madam Chairman, when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, I move Senate File 55 do pass, and I'd also like to move the Standing Committee amendments and have it read in.
Senate File 55, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 15.
Madam Chairman, we're dealing with subdivisions again. And we mix them up with cattle and horses and sheep, and we're trying to straighten it out and we had the realtors in, and this is the bill we came out with. On line 8, we're creating a new subsection 1 in Wyoming Statute 112806 to be amended to read line 10, 112806, construction and maintenance of partition fences. On line 13, little a, except otherwise provided, the owner of any lawful fence which is or becomes a partition fence separating the owner's land from the belonging to some other person may require the person to pay half. And then over on page 2, it says half of what would be, what would or does actually cost to construct the partition fence. In case of refusal, the owner may maintain a civil action against the person refusing and is entitled to recover half of what it would be to actually cost to construct the portion of the partition fence used by the person and cost of suit. And then we go down to little b, and that new section on line 2, line 15, we put in after fence. This is the standing committee amendment. The cost of the perimeter fence shall be paid for by the parties according with subsection A of this section. So, in other words, if the standard fence is a three-wire fence out there, that'll keep the cattle out because Wyoming has a fence out on cattle. But if it's a sheep outfit, then it has to be sheep tight to keep the sheep out. And if they want a fancier fence than that, why, the livestock owner or the person owning the livestock they're going to keep out would pay for either a three-wire fence or a woven wire three-wire fence if you're going to keep sheep in. And if they want a fancier fence than that, then the parties that are creating the subdivision will pay the above expense on that fence. That's the bill. That's what it does. If you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
Discussion on the amendment. Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just a question for the good chairman. I understand why you'd want the first section because of the in subsection A, you have to pay half of the fence on that kind of boundary fence. But the other part, the adjoining landowner should not be liable for damages caused by or arising from livestock pastured on the adjoining land that may wander onto subdivided land. I'm wondering why that language is there, because as the good chairman said, Wyoming's a fence out state, and so if you don't want cattle or livestock in your area, you have the obligation to fence them out so they don't come in. And not only are the landowner not liable for damage that may be caused, but if you harm a livestock, you are responsible. My friends in the insurance industry tell me that any time a cow or a bull wanders onto the road, that's always turned out to be the prize bull that would have won the county fair had it not been hit by that car. And so they're paid and compensated accordingly. But I'm just wondering why the additional language on the liability issue when I think that's already the law. If there was any discussion about that.
What line are you reading? On page 2? We're talking about on line 15, the construction of a perimeter fence, the adjoining landowner shall not be liable for any damage caused by or derived from livestock pasturing on the adjacent land that may wander onto the subdivision. Well, that's, I don't know if that's old law or new law. It's new in this bill.
Senator Driscoll.
Madam Chairman, thank you. I would like to elaborate a little. I don't have a good response to reply to you because I don't know where you live for sure. So I... In response, what this came about from is these new subdivisions coming in. You're correct. There is a subdivision law there. Wyoming's fence out for cattle. It is not for sheep. So what's occurred is these subdivisions come in against sheep ranches. It is now the responsibility of the guy that runs sheep or the guy that runs horses to build this new fence that's newly needed to appear between him and a neighbor. And in the cases, there's been a fence there. At different times, they're a three-wire fence and do not hold stuff out. And I can tell you firsthand, these subdivisions, it's really tough. It turns the tables on you on an old ranch that's run for a long time. And the three-wire fence worked great when it was cows across the fence or more sheep across the fence. No longer works when you got a garden across the fence or you've got a new lawn across the fence. And oftentimes subdivision fencing, particularly if it's right up against your fence, it needs to be something considerably better on than what Wyoming law is considered as legal fence. What it's really doing is saying, you know, let us be allowed to ranch and operate as we have in the past. And if someone wants to come in and be against it, let the burden be upon them, truly, to keep things as they have been. And this is a great law. It doesn't impose anything huge on anybody that's been there. If you're going to come, it says you need to play by Wyoming's rules and be a good neighbor. And it's just that simple.
Further discussion on the amendment?
Madam
Senator Cooper.
Madam Chairman. The question I have, and this is on the amendment too, is like, as it probably was mentioned earlier by the good shorter senator from Natrona County, shorter one. anyway, I know. The one that's in between. anyway, to get on with my question here, before I forget what it was, I don't know why all of a sudden, and we're all of a sudden, you know, we've had this law for over the years where we've had this fence out requirement in the law. Now all of a sudden we're saying, yeah, we have this fence out requirement, but now we're going to make the livestock owner pay half the cost. And so can maybe somebody in the committee explain that?
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I don't think it's actually the law. It's case law that says Wyoming is a fence-out state only for cattle. So if you look at the existing law that it pertains to all fencing other than a fence-out state pertaining to cattle, you know, everybody's obligated to pay half. So we have a sheep operation, and they put a subdivision in. And the purpose of the law, and that's really why you have the language on 15, starting with the adjoining going through line 18, is to provide incentive for that subdivider to want to put the fence in. And clearly the other points of the law say that it shall be a three-wire fence. Well, a three-wire fence won't keep the sheep out, but if they don't have more than that three-wire fence, the sheep are going to come in, and the person that's there that owns the sheep is not responsible for them. So there's incentive built in there for the subdivider to want to put the fence in. And then the purpose of the amendment is to say that, okay, recognize that you may have to put a better fence in. We're going to split the cost. So it's kind of a fair compromise to allow that to happen. And, of course, the real key thing that is it only pertains to subdivisions. So if you sell a ranch that's a cattleman and you got a sheep man, we're not going to have the Johnson County War starting all over again. And that's why it pertains only to subdivisions.
All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 55, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 55 passes. We are back on the bill. We'll proceed to the question on the bill. All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion, the when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 55, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Senate File 55 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 47. The reading clerk will read the Senate file.
Senate File 47, Concealed Weapons, an act relating to concealed weapons, sponsored by Senator Jennings. It was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue. Its reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Barnard, Case, Emmerich, and Perkins. No, Senator Hines. Senator Hines, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Hines.
Madam Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it does so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 47. There is a standing committee amendment, and I ask that it be read in at this time.
Senate File 47, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 14.
I move the standing committee amendment, and to explain the bill and the amendment, I'll yield to the sponsor, Senator Jennings.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. U.S. Constitution. Right to bear arms. The right of a citizen to bear arms in defense of themselves and of the state shall not be denied. Wyoming Constitution. Probably ought to just stop there, but of course you know I'm not. What I'd like to do is kind of go into the bill and explain it to you and tell you that what we want to do, and then we'll come back and talk about why a little bit. The crux of the bill is on page 2, starting on line 12. These are the statutes that outline what it takes to get a concealed weapon in Wyoming. Right now, that's a permit. What we're adding to that is the person does not possess a permit issued under this section, but otherwise meets the requirements specified in paragraphs B little I through the V little I of this section, and possession of firearms by the person is not otherwise unlawful. If you go back to the statute and you look at what those are, is that you have a whole list of things that you're supposed to do. And what we always do is we have to have a list of cannots. So a person's not eligible if he has not been committed or has had. He can get a permit if he hasn't done this. If he hasn't been committed to a state or federal facility for the abuse of a controlled substance within 1 year period prior to the date on which the application for a permit under this section is submitted. Under the changes of this bill, that's still in place. Rather than being up front, it's after the fact. Convicted of a felony violation of Wyoming Controlled Substance Act of 1971, 357-1001 through 357-1057, or similar laws of any other state or the United States relating to controlled substances, and has not been pardoned. Pretty straightforward. You can't be using drugs and controlled substance and be able to carry a firearm concealed. Convicted of a misdemeanor violation of all those same things for 1 year. So it's not only just a felony violation, but it's a misdemeanor also. Does not chronically or habitually use alcoholic liquor, malt beverages to the extent his normal facility is impaired. And it goes on about alcohol. So you can't be drinking a whole bunch and decide that you're going to go out and carry a concealed weapon. We leave those in place. But you go back to our Constitution and you realize that there's a couple words missing if we're going to do this. the end of the U.S. Constitution shall not be infringed. But there's no comma and then a but or if you do that. In our state constitution, shall not be denied. But there's not an if or but or anything like that after that comma. So in our constitutions, we have this right. But over the years, we've piled on reasons not to do it. Now you're going to hear some people probably talk about, well, if we do this, there's going to be this big rash of people carrying guns and committing crimes. Currently, in Wyoming, you can open carry. You can strap her on and walk any place you want. Now, if we were going to have this rush of people that now have the difference of carrying it on their hip or between the cloth in their jacket, I don't see that group of people out there. We have, in Wyoming, where we have a heritage of guns and hunting, we have a lot of responsible people. Another thing that we have to abide by in the carry law is the U.S. section. And we've already had a little bit of introduction to that. But you've got to go back and look at what really the federal government tells us about carrying. It's unlawful for you to carry a gun if you've been convicted in any court of a crime punishable by imprisonment for a term exceeding 1 year. Federal law. And it's in our state law that we're going to abide by this. Who is a fugitive from justice? I like that one, because if you're a fugitive from justice, are you really going to be worried about whether you're carrying a gun? You probably are going to have one, and it might even be why you're a fugitive. Who is an unlawful user of or addicted to any controlled substance? Back, we have that repeated in our state law. Who has been adjudicated as a mental defective or has been committed to a mental institution? That makes sense. Who's being an alien is illegally or unlawfully in the United States. That makes sense. We don't want illegal aliens to come in here and start carrying guns. Who has been discharged from the armed forces under dishonorable conditions. There's a reason to be sure you get an honorable discharge from the military. Who has been a citizen of the United States and has renounced his citizenship. I can't argue with that one either. And then we go into the domestic violence part of this that was put in the 70s. And if you've been convicted of domestic violence or harassing, stalking, threatening an intimate partner or child and through that, well, that's all in there too. And that part of the U.S. Code goes so far that if your job requires you to carry a gun and you're convicted of that, you can't carry your gun anymore. So that's how serious the federal law is on this. We're also going to talk, we'll have people talk about, well, what about all these people that are going to show up and start committing crimes? Well, let's look at Vermont. Vermont has never had a carry bill. Never. They've always depended on the U.S. Code. And there's nothing in their statute to say we're going to depend on it. They just don't have anything there. So people carry guns in Vermont. They've got, I think in committee somebody looked it up, and because the question was asked how many people live in Vermont. I think the number was around 600 and some thousand. So they have a considerable number of people in a little bitty place compared to where we are. In Vermont, in 2009, I got a list of all kinds of crimes that they had. They had larceny, and other was like 4,000 time, drugs and narcotic violations, 2,700 times. You know, and a lot of people would automatically try to connect the drug traffic problem with a gun. But in their weapons violations, they had 60. I think this gives you, good basis to understand that, and this is one of those states out east, that they don't have a carry permit. They don't have laws against carrying. People have been carrying concealed and open in Vermont since they started. And in 2009, they only had 60. weapons violations in 600-some-thousand people? It's fundamental. Of what do we want to do in Wyoming? Do we want to continue to have a law that I feel kind of pushes me back in a corner, because it was kind of neat. And I remember when I first stood there and took that oath, it was right there. It was kind of neat watching the new guys and the reelected guys taking that oath. But you know, in that oath we say we're going to support, obey, and defend the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of Wyoming. That's all I'm asking you to do here.
Discussion on the amendment. Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, I've got a series of amendments that we'll get to in a minute, but we can actually take care of one of them just by discussing the Standing Committee amendment now. Ultimately, I voted in favor of both the bill and this amendment, but in thinking about it, a couple of points I just want folks to consider about that before they vote, and we'll be really quick when you just vote up or down on this one. But ultimately, what we do is, what Standing Committee Amendment number one is, it removes a certain provision, which is a requirement, and that was in trying to basically align this essentially as the pattern is what it would take to have a permit. A concealed carry permit, in order to carry without a permit, you kind of line up essentially with most of, not all, but most of the same requirements for a concealed carry permit to carry without. But the one, what Standing Committee Amendment number one does is that we removed the provision that would require that is a resident of the United States and has been a resident of Wyoming for not less than 6 months prior to filing the application. The effect of Standing Committee Amendment number one is we took that out, and then but we inserted that it just had to be a resident of the United States. So all we did is remove the Wyoming residency requirements. Seemed like a good idea in committee as I thought about it and visited with some people after meeting. A couple of issues came up that I just wanted to bring the body's attention as they vote on Standing Committee Amendment number one, is that there are certain groups that visit Wyoming from time to time that have a reputation for lawlessness, and sometimes that this is what you have is basically if you have a Wyoming driver's license and you have a concealed weapon and you have a Wyoming driver's license, it's probably a done deal, you're on your way and there's no real issue. If you don't have a Wyoming driver's license, then you would have violated the law. It also keeps in line with the other requirements. It would not prevent anybody who's visiting, whether they're with a group with a reputation for lawless activity or not, would not prevent them from open carry. Other than that, I just wanted to bring the body's attention. That's what the amendment does. And so in thinking better about that, I thought that I'd just have that discussion now, and we can vote on that, and that'll dispense with one of the committee of the whole amendments. So vote it up or vote it down, but I just wanted to make sure we knew what that amendment did. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Senator Perkins, are you entering an amendment to the amendment?
No, I'm just rising and saying if we have the discussion about Senate Amendment number, the Standing Committee Amendment, it's the same thing as the Committee of the Whole Amendment. So whether we vote on this, we'll just end up withdrawing that other amendment because we'll have the discussion now. So what I'm saying is I'm just rising in opposition to Standing Committee Amendment number one, and that's the reason why.
Thank you, Senator Perkins. Senator Case.
Yes, Madam Chair. I rise to support the Standing Committee Amendment. I think the action of the Standing Committee Amendment to extend the rights to conceal carry to all residents of the United States, people that are protected by the Constitution of the United States, which, of course, is where we get our original right to keep and bear arms. You know, I'm not... I never know where to exactly draw the line, Madam Chairman. I mean, if a person comes into Wyoming, they qualify for all those things, but they happen to ride a two-wheeled vehicle that makes a loud noise, and maybe they got a tattoo, and they might refer to themselves as angels at one time or another, or have other names. If I don't have another reason to deny them under our law, I don't think we should do so. And so just what they look like, who they ride with, that's kind of weird. I just think that the Constitution and the right to keep and bear arms is really without regard to state borders. We should recognize that right to people that are entitled to the protection of the Constitution when they visit Wyoming.
Any other discussion of the amendment? Having heard the question, all those in favor of Senator Hines' motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 47, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No. Division.
Having called division, all those in favor, please rise.
So well.
All those opposed, please rise.
Now you only have so much juice in a day. You only have so much juice.
The motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 47 has failed. We are back on the bill. We will hear Amendment Number 2. Reading clerk, if you will please read.
Before we do that, I'll just withdraw Standing Committee the whole Amendment Number 1 since we've already dealt with that. Excuse me, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1. Thank you.
Having Amendment Number 2 being withdrawn?
No.
No.
Point of order, that amendment would be Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for that correction. Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 has been withdrawn. So we will proceed with, we're back on the bill. We will proceed. We will proceed with Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2. If the reading clerk will please read that.
Senate File 47, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2, page 2, line 16.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I would, at this point in time, move that for the adoption of Standing Committee of the Whole Amendment, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2, the Senate File 47, request that we dispense with further reading of the amendment. The purpose of this is, I believe that there was a little bit of an oversight in listing the qualifications. So what this bill does is it goes in addition to the qualifications that the good senator, my fellow senator from Natrona County went through, that was 21 years of age, resident of Wyoming, resident of the state, United States, and now with the Standing Committee Amendment being not approved, it also resident of the state of Wyoming, not suffering from any physical infirmity, is not eligible to possess a firearm pursuant to 18 U.S.C. section, those sections, or Wyoming Statute 68102. This adds two additional provisions. It brings in also in the requirement is these what Romanet 8 would do, which is the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2. What Romanet 8 is not currently adjudicated to be legally incompetent, and Romanet 9, which would insert this is also a requirement to be able to carry concealed with no permit, is has not been committed to a mental institution. So we're adding those two requirements as additional prohibitions for carrying concealed. Seems to me a logical and reasonable amendment to the bill, and I ask for your favorable consideration.
We'll go to discussion of Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2. Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Seeing that this is also covered under the federal code that we just went through, I don't look at this as a hostile or unfriendly amendment.
Having heard for the question, All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Amendment number 2, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Committee of the Whole, Amendment number 2 passes. Will the reading clerk please read Amendment number 3?
Senate File 47, Committee of the Whole, Amendment number 3, page 1, line 4.
Discussion on Amendment number 3. Sergeant, Senator Perkins. Excuse me.
Madam Chairman, at this time I'd move Committee of the Whole Amendment number 3 to Senate File 47 and ask for a favorable consideration of this amendment. What this amendment does is, if you'll look, what we have in the existing statute, and you see it in the first part of the bill, is that a person who wears or carries a concealed deadly weapon is guilty of a misdemeanor punishable by a fine of not more than $750 or imprisonment in the county jail for not more than 6 months or both, unless, and then we have the requirements. What this would do, Committee of the Whole Amendment number 3 does, is gives you one bite at the apple. And right now you could have repetitive violations of the concealed weapons law, either with or without a permit. You could have a series of those, and none of them would ever be more than a misdemeanor. It would seem to me that in this instance we're recognizing that privilege, Madam Chairman, but in recognizing and granting people that privilege, there also comes with it a significant responsibility. Obviously, particularly firearms, we're talking about deadly weapons, all carry with them oftentimes consequences that are irreversible and sometimes immutable. And in doing so, it seemed to me that repeated offenses of that deserve more than just a misdemeanor. And so also incumbent in this is recognizing that if you choose to exercise your right to carry a concealed weapon, that you also comes with it a certain and heavy responsibility. And in recognizing that, if you don't get the message on the first one, which is a misdemeanor, on the second one it would be a felony, and of course intended of that would be you would actually lose your right to bear firearms at all, concealed or unconcealed, because that would be the conviction, that would be a felony under that. And so with that, I would ask for your favorable consideration on committee amendment, Committee of the Whole Amendment number 3.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just a question, and certainly if this bill does become law, you can still go ahead and get your permit the way we have it now, so you can have reciprocity with other states, whatever you may want to do. So would your amendment, if passes, affect all people with any kind of weapon they would carry, or are you just talking about under the new provision that they don't have to have the permitting process at all? So if I do decide to carry a permit and I should have a second offense, then this would apply to me, or would it not?
Senator Perkins.
My understanding is yes, it would. The way that this bill's written and the way it will be after this goes, this is going to apply to all concealed carry. Any violation of concealed carry would have those penalties, whether it's permitted or unpermitted.
Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the violation would be already having a felony or whatever the other, being an illegal immigrant, whatever is listed that you can't carry a gun, a concealed gun, because you're not having a violation anymore for a permit, which I think was the number one concern. It would be for anything else that's listed that would not allow you to carry a concealed weapon. That's what the violation is.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I believe the violation would be, if we go to the statute, the violation would be if you're carrying a concealed weapon, and either one, you don't qualify under one of the exceptions for concealed weapons. So it's going to be anybody who qualifies and carries a permit, they're not going to be subject to that unless they violated by. No, it's just that's just what it is, unless they meet those requirements. So ultimately, if you don't qualify to carry a permit or you don't qualify to have a non-permitted concealed carry, that's the violation. Does that answer the question? So, in other words, if you're not a resident of the United States, or you're not a resident of Wyoming and you get caught twice, or if you're adjudicated mentally incompetent, or you've been committed to a mental institution and they catch you twice with a concealed weapon, you would have committed a felony. If that answers your question, Senator.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I think this amendment makes sense, and I would urge you to support it. And back to my colleague from Fremont County, what we're doing here doesn't go into any of the reciprocity thing. So if you want a permit so that you have reciprocity, then you can still go through all the same things. We're not changing any of that. You can get your permit and qualify for reciprocity with all the other states.
Senator Case.
I'll just sit down, Ms. Madam Chair.
Having the question been called, all those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion to adopt the Committee of the Whole's Amendment Number 3 to Senate File 47, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The motion carries. The amendment passes. We are back on the bill.
Madam Chairman,
Senator,
I'm going to ask for the yeas and nays on the question.
Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman, I can't ask for the yeas and nays in committee of the whole. And if you're going to, you have to ask before the vote.
Other discussion on the bill? Senator Hines.
Madam Chairman, I was a voted no in the committee, and I will just give a short report from what we got in the committee. We had three sponsors talk in favor of the bill. We had 12 other people that testified. Six of them had reservation or opposed the bill. Five of them was completely for the bill. One attorney, I'm not sure whether he's opposed or for it, but he spoke and brought up a lot of issues. Personally, my concern with the bill is that I'm afraid there'll be a lot of people will not follow it, just like we discussed here earlier with the seatbelt law, that a lot of people don't pay any attention to certain laws. For the average person to realize what the qualifications are, I just can't see them doing that. I think when this bill, if it became law, they'll go ahead and carry their concealed weapons and not realizing that they have to meet all those 12, 14 issues, whatever it is. Virtually every law enforcement person that tested had either opposed it or had great concerns about the results from this type of a law. They told us that there was currently Wyoming have 21,000 permits in Wyoming, and there is only a little over 1% that have been denied. So the people that need the permit can pretty well get them. On my personal beliefs, when we talk about the Constitution, I think the argument is not the constitutional words, but how we interpret it. We can and we are not denied anything in Wyoming because of the permit. We can carry a open carry, however you pronounce it, as long as in sight. And so the argument is about whether they can be concealed or not concealed. I was also told by one law enforcement officer, and I don't know whether that's correct or not, he says that this possibly will jeopardize our reciprocal laws with other states, and therefore anybody with a permit may not be able to carry that weapon in another state. This is just some of the things that we discussed in committee.
President Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As I rise to speak neither for nor against the bill, I have to share with you some thoughts and feelings that I have that were brought to me by a good friend who's a very respected retired law enforcement person. I, too, am, under the current law, a concealed carry permit holder and have gone on record saying that I'm satisfied with the law. Excuse me a minute. I'm satisfied with the current law the way it is. However, I have to say one of the things that was shared with me by the retired law enforcement officer, and this is after having ridden with a highway patrolman after dark in the night. And as I sat in the car and watched him walk up to a car in the dark, I really had some fear and trepidation for them, realizing that they do this repeatedly. Well, the point of the thing is the retired officer shared with me that in instances where there is I questioned about this registry, but, you know, I as a permit holder, I'm on record with the local county sheriff, given his review and whatnot, but when an officer walks up to at least a Wyoming car in the dark, he can call dispatch and see if, in fact, this person is a permit holder and might, in fact, have a weapon. So this current method or current system that we have does offer, I think, some element of protection to those law enforcement people. I've not been a law enforcement person. I'm not a wannabe law enforcement person, but I just know that in witnessing these people walking up to a car in the dark, that's something I wouldn't want to do. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Standing up in opposition to this, our system seems to work, and it seems to work quite well. And what I gather from this is that it'll take a confrontation to actually question whether you are mentally unstable, are a felon, an illegal immigrant. And that confrontation is probably going to be more than the police officer just asking for a permit. It is going to take some action, which is probably going to hurt somebody or be deadly before he even finds out whether you qualify. I don't think that's right. I think our system works. It's also very confusing, because if you go down here, it says that on the new language, but otherwise meets the requirements specified in paragraphs B1 and 6. And then that paragraph, B1 and 6, goes in the Attorney General is authorized to issue permits. So on one end, it says, it doesn't say you have to follow it. It says, but required. You meet the requirements. Well, that's really confusing, and I see that ending up in court, too, and we'll be paying for that lawsuit defending our statute. So not a great bill, not written very well either.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, I guess for information is what really a concealed weapon is. And I'm guessing if I've got my hunting shotgun thrown in my back seat and I've got my hunting coat over it and we're headed out to the goose pit, and for whatever reason I'm now going 46 miles an hour on a unpaved road and I get pulled over without a seatbelt, and the officer comes up there and looks in the back seat and says, "What have you got back there?" And says, "That's my hunting rifle." Am I breaking the law right now? Is that concealed? And I'm wondering whether it is concealed. And I'm thinking some of the unintended consequences that might be in our current law, where if this law was in effect, that some of these people that are perhaps concealing a weapon, but it really isn't. They have no hostile intent or any means. Is there a situation that in our current law there's some unintended consequences, and this law will actually actually help those unintended consequences.
Senator Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm an esteemed friend from LaGrange. I believe that's very true, as we've overlooked huge parts of our concealed law at this point in time. We all pack guns around in cases and things. And I think it helps clarify from that end. I think virtually everybody that hunts and fishes in Wyoming packs concealed weapons, and it's overlooked at this point. That's going to change as time goes on. You're going to hear arguments in here on why you need to go get a permit so you can do what we've traditionally done in Wyoming. And on the flip side of it, back to the people that have been addressed that are real dangers, your convicts, your illegal people, those guys are all going to carry guns concealed, unconcealed, or otherwise. I mean, the convicts forever. The bad guys, they have guns. That end of it, this law is not going to, in all honesty, has no address on people that are open and notorious about breaking the law. Those guys are still going to do it. It only allows people that are there to be able to do what the Constitution has told us to. And, you know, what the good senator from Casper read, his first two statements, and he said he talked about sitting down. Think about those really hard, because that's the rules that we all run by. And they're clear. There's no fudge room on them. There's not a statement at the end of them. This is Wyoming Constitution, federal Constitution. There's not any ifs, ands, or buts. It says you will be allowed. And with that by itself, I don't think there should be a whole lot of argument on this. It's pretty clear and simple. I'll stand at that.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. There's sort of three categories here. My good esteemed colleague pointed out the bad guys, and it's true. There's nothing we can do to legislate for the bad guys. They're going to carry if they want to carry. They're the bad guys. That's what they do. The good guys, right now, we have in place legislation that allows good guys to carry concealed weapons according to the statutes. It's a fair and reasonable system. We've heard testimony that indicates that it's effective. There's lots of permits, about 21,000. Very few of them are turned down, only less than 1%. The people that I'm concerned with most about this bill is the third category, which I'm going to call the incompetent. The incompetent are the people who aren't qualified because they don't have sufficient training to carry a weapon and to use it effectively. Current statute has 9 provisions that you have to meet before you're eligible to have a statute. This bill that we're considering today, as amended, requires 8 of those 9 to be in place. Kind of makes you curious what was carved out. Well, what was carved out was provision Romanet 7, which is a requirement that you actually know what you're doing, that you have had some training and can demonstrate having had training, that you've been in the military, that you've been law enforcement, that you've done something at some point that indicates that you actually know how to use a weapon. Now, we're talking about rights and individual rights and freedoms, and this is a good point. Obviously, we do have the right to keep and bear arms, but we also have the right to safety, and courts have ruled time and again that when rights come into conflict, that's when you have to make the hard decision. Now, I think we have a good system in place that makes a measured decision right now. It's a reasonable decision. It allows qualified people to carry concealed because that seems safe, and it's been safe. But I'm very concerned about a situation where now anybody who goes out, goes to the store, buys a weapon, has no idea what they're doing with it, can now be walking next to me with my kids. Do their rights trump my rights and my children's rights? Because I don't think they do. I don't want their concealed carry rights to override the safety of my children and my rights to protect them. If they're open carry, I can avoid them. I can say, that person doesn't look like they know how to shoot that gun. I'm going to walk across the street. But if they've got it in their jacket, tied with a string, with the hammer back because they have no idea what they're doing, and they bend over and it drops on the ground, that's a reality that we're going to face, and that's a reality that's allowed under this if we don't provide for the training and don't require the training. And this bill, as written, doesn't do that, and I stand in opposition to the bill. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. With my new friend from Laramie, if that's your only problem with the bill and we can get a positive vote on it today, then I would suggest you bring that training amendment up on second reading. With my new friend from Laramie also, this bill would allow those retired peace officers to carry their arms in the state of Wyoming.
Senator Burns.
Sponsor. This is a question that came up when this bill was over on the other end of the Capitol last year, and I never got a question, an answer to it. A couple of years ago, we conformed our gun carry permits to make sure that it was had reciprocity in about 23 or 30 other states, and so the question was asked: if we pass a bill of this sort, what does that do to the reciprocity in other states? Does it cancel it, or is it unaffected? If this bill passes, do we do away with concealed weapons permits entirely? Those are questions that I'm just kind of wondering about, and I think the people in this body should know before we vote on this bill.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'd like to address the issue of how this bill works with the permit system and reciprocity. As you may know, Madam Chairman, I was involved in several of our permit-based concealed carry bills over the years. We will maintain a dual system. You'll be able to carry under this bill. It's called constitutional carry. And you would also be able to apply, complete the requirements, pay the money, and receive a permit. The permit would give you the privilege of carrying in other states that recognize our permit system, and there are more than 23 states. Now, I can't tell you the exact number. I didn't check it recently. But, yes, we changed our law last year, if you will recall, so that we could be even in more conformance with reciprocity states. That system works great. People are happy with that system. It's not the only system we need, mind you, but it is a system that if you're willing to pay the money you would be able to receive a permit and carry into that system. This doesn't affect that system. Reciprocity is not endangered in the least. And I think people just haven't really looked that we are indeed maintaining the permit system for that exact reason. So I support this bill, Madam Chairman. It doesn't impact our permit-based system and the reciprocity you would have to carry in other states. But I do know that a person that chooses to constitutionally carry in Wyoming without a permit would not enjoy that same reciprocity. And they'd have to figure out and be at their own risk to make sure that the state they go to and carry would not find that to be a crime. And I note that since we don't allow residents of other states to come in and carry constitutionally, that would be a crime in our state. So even with this bill, as it has been with the removal of standing committee amendment. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I do support the bill. I hope you all will, too. The sky is not falling. People who exercise their Second Amendment rights are citizens that are responsible. This notion that you have a bunch of Barney Fifes running around and fumbling things is not proven out on anything. It hasn't been proven out by our permit system. And I realize that's not necessarily what's going to happen with a non-permit system. But believe me, people that take their constitutional rights very seriously are responsible. We will find that this will be an effective system, and this system will save lives. It'll prevent crime. It'll uphold our oath to the Constitution of the United States and the state of Wyoming. And it'll give what our citizens want and are asking you to do.
Question having been asked, all those in favor of Senator Hines' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 47, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Division. All those in favor, please rise. All those opposed, please stand. Senate File 47 has passed the committee as a whole. The next bill for our consideration is... Excuse me. Senator Nicholas.
Thank you. The members of the Appropriation Committee, we are now meeting in the to begin markup of the budget.
The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 58.
Senate File 58, Landowners' Rights in Wind Energy Development, and Act Relating to Industrial Siting for Wind Energy Facilities, sponsored by Senator Anderson. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State, Public Lands, and Water Resources, and reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Driscoll, Emmerich, Geis, and Hicks, Senator Geis, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure?
Madam Chairman, whole riding report. I move Senate File 58 do pass, and I'd also like to move the Standing Committee amendments and have it read in.
Senate File 58, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 5, line 3.
Madam Chairman, I'll yield the floor to the President of the Senate to explain this bill.
President Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, I think the first thing we'll do is that the amendment has been moved. It's a very simple amendment, and we would just take care of that. If you'll go to page 5, it was changing on line 3 the word government at the end of the line, adding S, making that governments. And so with that, I would call for the question on the amendment.
The question on the amendment having been called, all those in favor of Senator Anderson's motion that Senator Geis's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises, in favor of Senator Geis's motion to adopt the Standing Committee number 1 to Senate File 58, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment to Senate File 58 passes. We are now back on the bill.
President. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, before I actually go into the bill, I want to just give a little background in what prompts this bill. Madam Chairman, I have in hand here a draft of all the industrial siting county, industrial siting development and siting council regulations that were worked on in regard to wind development. There was a considerable amount of effort put into this by one of our members on the floor. We have so many descriptions of the Natrona County delegation. I guess I would call him the Goldilocks senator in it. He's neither too tall nor too short. But anyway, this bill that I bring today is to embellish an already good set of regulations, and it just takes in recognition in regard to wind development. We know that wind development is a rapidly expanding industry in Wyoming, and as it expands, it makes its way across the landscape, and many instances then makes its way onto private land. Lands owned in, by private ownership, and so it's brought partly in response to those private owners in regard to private property rights and that. So having said that, much of this bill just embellishes or adds a statement in recognition of those private landowners in regard to wind rights. Senate File 58 is landowner rights and wind energy to develop, and this is an act, as it says, relating to industrial siting for wind energy facilities, requiring the identification of specified landowners, giving specified landowners the right to notice and other participation rights, requiring the disclosure of specified industrial siting information, expanding the persons entitled to be parties in the industrial siting process, and providing for an effective date. I guess an overriding and umbrella factor in this would be the idea of transparency and full disclosure to those landowners that might be affected. Just a bit about in regard to the sections of the Industrial Siting Council process. Before we actually get into that, I guess definitions of what the affected landowner would be are important. So if you look at the bill, page 2, line 4 down through line 12, the definition of affected landowner as it applies into this legislation means any person holding record title to land on which any portion of a commercial facility generating electricity from wind is proposed to be constructed, including any portion of any collector system located on those same lands. For purposes of this chapter, an affected landowner may also be represented by a designated person. So as we use this term, affected landowner, throughout, that's the definition that we'll be making reference to. Looking at the different sections within this Industrial Siting Council legislation, 3512107 relates to the request for a waiver or permit application. And this, of course, is when a developer would want to make a waiver in regard to the permit application. It talks about that shall contain the following information for proposed facilities meeting all the requirements. And then it would ask for a list of those affected landowners, and with their addresses of those affected landowners be given. So then that would require them to identify those affected landowners. They have then, as it says, a 7-day period there. And then they would then serve notice on the request upon the governing bodies of the local governments, which will be primarily affected by the proposed facility. And then we add it again, and for proposed facilities meeting requirements again upon affected landowners. So those affected landowners would be given notification. We go on down, and again, line 19, notification in that, further down in that process of affected landowners. Going over on page 4, continuing on, notify the applicant and local governments of the hearing, and also, again, notification to those affected landowners. Going into another section regarding the application for permits, the form, the fee, and others, 3512109. An application for permit shall be filed with the division, and then again it shall contain this following information, requiring all affected landowners with an address for which each affected landowner would be given a notice by this act. Again, the courtesy of notification, 3512110, near the bottom of page 4, service of notification of application, application, deficiencies, procedure, jurisdiction, all those other procedures. Again, not only would it include those governing bodies and local governments, but also, again, the inclusion of affected landowners. Again, going further down in that process, local governments of a hearing, anything in that area, would, again, notification affected landowners. 2223 at the bottom of page 5, again, another recognition for any of those proposed facilities that meet those requirements. The division shall request information and recommendation from affected landowners. And what this would do, misspoken. They shall request information, recommendations for an affected landowner. This gives the affected landowner an opportunity by request to respond. Many of these individuals, as we know, work pretty hard. They're ranchers. They would be involved to the extent that they want to be. Perhaps they really don't have time or don't feel necessary to respond, but they would receive a request. That would be an option on their part, whether or not to follow up on that request. That would have to do with relative to the impact of the proposed facilities, as it applies then again to affected landowners, lands, and their interest thereof. So anyway, it goes on to say then these would, for not less than 25 days prior to any scheduled hearing on the application, the director would then provide all affected landowners a copy of the information received from these different agencies providing information under these subdivisions. Of anything in this bill that really speaks to the genesis of this, this bill really came out requested of me as a result of the department that is in charge of wild things recently came forward with some what they call best practice regulations that had a heavy impact, and in many instances the landowner felt that these were an imposition upon their private property rights. Through this process, the landowners felt like they had not received proper notification. They were not allowed to participate in the conversation. Quite frankly, they felt like that this was really tread upon their private property rights. So that's when they, many individuals, a number in my district, along with another organization that represents many of these people that grow livestock, came to me and asked for me to do something in regard to private property rights, landowner rights, so that that would not then happen again, where landowners now really get upfront notification in regard to this process. So it goes on to say at the last lines 10 through 16 that these agencies in providing opinions and recommendations under this subsection of this section shall receive comments from affected landowners, giving them an opportunity to comment on some of these things that would so have so much effect upon private land. And then they shall provide a summary of all the affected landowner comments with other information that has been submitted. So if these comments are received after the agency's other information is submitted, the comments shall then be forwarded on and received by the division. So it really tries to open up that whole process of exchange of ideas, information in regard to the permitting process and how these landowners might be affected. 3512, 111, lines 18, going on down to the bottom of page 6, has to do parties to permit proceeding waiver by failure to participate. It goes on to the current language, and what it does then on line 8, first word in the line, adds the term agriculture, along with those other things that they would do in terms of the biological values, to preserve historical sites, to promote consumer interest, to present commercial agriculture and industrial groups. So then another recognition statement of the agricultural industry. Finally, the final section in this proposal is 3512.113, having to do with the decision of a council and the findings necessary for permit conditions imposed, service of decision on parties, waste management, surcharge, talks about the timeline of 45 days, and it goes on to then further explain some of the regulatory agency requests that conditions be imposed. And again, on line 7 through 11, final page at 8, it says, in consideration, the imposition of conditions requested by other agencies upon private lands, the council shall consider in the same manner and to the same extent any objection raised in oral or written testimony by the affected landowner. And so I would just say throughout those sections that I've just cited, it's again recognition of the private property rights of these landowners within the state, and it's an opportunity to engage them in this conversation in regard to the siting of industrial wind projects within their boundaries or that might lay within their holdings and lands that they were owners of are responsible to. Madam Chairman, that's the bill, and I would then take any questions from the body. Thank you.
Discussion of the bill. The question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Geis's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that to do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 58, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
Madam Chairman, may I have privilege of the floor just a moment?
Yes, you may, President.
Madam Chairman, in an earlier comment, you may have witnessed me flinch and winch and whatnot, and I really am quite flattered by the concern that it prompted. I tend to be a kind of a victim of spasms, and so that's what you witness. It's nothing dangerous, and you're going to have to put up with me for a while longer, I'm afraid. Thank you.
President Anderson, you have our sympathy. Thank you for the explanation. I'm glad you're all right. Senate File 58 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Senator Ross.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You have heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carried. Thank you, President Anderson.
The reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs to report as follows. Senate File 10, do pass amended. Senate File 17, do pass. Senate File 51, do pass. Senate File 97, failed to pass Committee of the Whole and was indefinitely postponed. Senate File 55, do pass amended. Senate File 47, do pass amended. And Senate File 58, do pass amended. Senator Nutting, Chairman.
Senator Nutting.
Mr. President, I move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion is carried. That report has been adopted. Do we have any reports from the standing committees?
January the 20th, 2011, Mr. President, your Committee Number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred Senate File 108, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Barnard, Case, Emmerich, Hines, and Perkins, Senator Hines, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate stand adjourned until 10 a.m., tomorrow morning, January 21st.
Announcement, Senator Geis.
Mr. President, Committee Number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources. We'll meet in about 10 minutes. We're going to take up Senate File 65, Animal Remedies. Senate File 81, the Omnibus Water Bill Construction. Senate File 87, Temporary Interim Flow. And Senate File 111, Game Animal Damage.
Senator Scott.
President. Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services. We'll meet in the normal committee room at the normal time, 8 a.m. tomorrow morning. Senate File 50, Medicaid Option Study. Senate File 102, Medicaid Cost Study.
Thank you, Senator Coe.
Hey, Mr. President, your Committee Number 4, Education, will meet at 7:30 tomorrow in Room 302 to begin receiving testimony and have debate on Senate File 52, Teacher Tenure.
Senator Burns.
Mr. President, I was remiss in that I was not here when we reconvened after lunch, and you read in Senate File 62. large project funding sponsored by the it's sponsored by the Natural Resource Funding Standing Committee. It has an appropriation. I ask that you re-refer it to Committee Number 2 Appropriations.
Senate File 62 has been requested to be referred to Committee Number 2. Seeing no objections, it's so ordered. Thank you, Senator Burns. Any other? Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Committee Number 1 Judiciary will meet Friday, January the 21st at 8 a.m. This is a little bit different than the last notice. We'll be meeting, instead of S1, we'll be meeting in the larger conference room in the Hersher Building, B63, at 8 o'clock to take up Senate File 67, Guardianship of Ward Sealed Records, Senate File 68, Summary of Probate Amendments, and finish up with the testimony and the consideration of Senate Joint Resolution 5, Defense of Marriage Constitutional Amendment.
Thank you, Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Committee Number 9 Minerals will meet tomorrow, Friday, January 21st, 15 minutes after the recess in room S8 meeting to discuss Senate Resolution 6, Environmental Protection Regulations, Senate File 116, Oil and Gas Enhanced Recovery by Corio Conversion, and Senate File 119, Real Estate Brokers and Sales Division 2. Mr. President, earlier this Committee Number 9 Minerals Monday, January 20th, February 24th, 15 minutes after the recess, the organization meeting to continue with necessary discussion on Senate File 119, real estate brokers and sales revision, and Senate File 120, workforce services, and employment reorganization.
Thank you, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Committee Number 12, Rules, will meet tomorrow upon adjournment in S5 to continue our work on Senate File 95, Legislative Committee Membership.
Are there any other announcements? Pretty solid day, a lot of heavy lifting. Maybe that's what made my back hurt. I'm not so sure. But anyway, good work. Let's come back tomorrow at 10 o'clock. You've heard the motion. The Senate will stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow, January 21st.
Aye.
Aye.